From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, a conversation with Texas Monthly's Skip Hollingsworth.
Support for this podcast of Texas Matters comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company by investing in local communities and rewarding policyholders for prioritizing safety. They are building a more resilient Texas. More at texasmutual.com/texansgetit. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. I recently had the honor to host a conversation with Texas Monthly's Skip Hollingsworth about his new book, She Kills, The Murderous Socialite, The Cross-Dressing Bank Robber, and Other True Crime Tales. Let's get to it.
Well, thank y'all. So one of the benefits of being here tonight is being able to really hear Skip, because when you hear his voice and how he talks, it adds another dimension to when you read his writing. The way he talks and the way he writes, you're talking to someone who really knows how to tell a story. And you hear him tonight, and he's really going to give it to you. And you're never going to be able to read his stuff again without hearing his voice. It is distinctive. It is luxurious. It is Skip. And so, Skip, thank you so much for coming in here tonight.
Y'all are sick people coming out here on a rainy night.
It's just unbelievable. True crime fanatics. Look at you. And I'm really stunned that anybody would buy this book, but go right ahead.
So let's talk about She Kills. You're to blame for the true crime genre that we have today. People finding it and finding something in there that speaks to them beyond just the police blotter part of a crime. So we know when we see a story, what's going on there? There's more to it than just someone snapped and they did something awful. What put you on this path? What was your trigger?
Well, I grew up in Wichita Falls. I was the son of a Presbyterian minister. I played the cello in the school orchestra. I was the Yo-Yo Ma of Wichita Falls. I was an Eagle Scout. I volunteered at the state lunatic asylum. I was as white bread of an American boy as you came. And, you know, I just thought I'd become a minister too, cheerfully preaching the gospel of Jesus and trying to ignore the shadow side of life. Well, at the lunatic asylum, there was a rumor that began that nymphomaniacs lived in the dorm number 7. And so a group of my friends and I kept trying to figure out how to get to dorm number 7. We failed. But in my junior year in high school, the summer after my junior year in high school, there was a story that began to get reported out about this handsome, lean wildcatter, rich woman, rich as chocolate, married to this beautiful ex-model who took their private plane and flew it from Wichita Falls to Dallas, which is a flight of about 10 minutes, so that she could stop at Neiman Marcus and buy outfits. Somebody had broken into their mansion, which was like an 8,000-square-foot mansion on top of a hill, filled with burglar alarms, guard dogs, state-of-the-art security. They had a mailbox that was giant elephant tusk, about 7 feet tall, that the wife had shot on one of the safaris. They were this mythical couple, and they were found shot to death in their separate beds in 74. Wow, it's hard to be interviewed by journalists, isn't it?
June 74.
Shot to death in their separate beds, and no one could figure out what had happened. So the assumption was someone had gotten through the security system and shot Bobby and then shot his wife, Abby, and left the gun right beside where Abby was laying in her bed. Well, there was just an uproar, and I felt this kind of fascination.
So how did you hear about this the first
newspaper
time?
My dad brought in the newspaper and it said, multimillionaire woman and wife found dead in home. I became sort of it was my first murder story to cover. And, you know, I didn't write a story, but I would like swim at the country club past Wichita Falls moms who were gossiping, hoping to pick up a little bit. I always thought, you know, that the killer could still be hidden somewhere in Wichita Falls. And who knows who next he will be.
I found this whole side of myself beginning to emerge. Turns out that the medical examiner released a report that said the wife had shot her husband to death and then climbed back into her bed with the pistol and shot herself to death. And the pistol fell off the side of the bed and landed on the floor. I was fixated, and I could not stop thinking about how could this have happened. It was not a whodunit, it was a whydunit. And I think that's the kind of thing that drives a lot of Texas Monthly stories that we all do, is what causes people to cross this invisible line that they never, no one ever expected them to cross.
She shot herself in the stomach, okay, in the bed. That's not typically the way a person will try to end their own life. Was she trying to make it look like that someone had broken in? Or
did she not want, did she want to die with her face untouched? You know? I mean, this is what we were doing at our church Sunday night youth group. There was no arrest. The case soon got moved on. The newspapers weirdly stopped covering it. I went on to college, still haunted by the ghosts of Bobby and Abby Burns.
Well, Wichita Falls is still haunted by the story. I was on their Facebook page, and there are still people who talk about this. You know, this is something that has not left that community.
When I knew I was going to write that story, which ran in the October issue of Texas mm-hmm. Monthly called My First Murder, and to this day, when I went up there again, the rumors are rife with why she did it. Why would she kill her husband and then do herself in? Why would she cross the line? You're expecting me to give you the answer, aren't you?
But it's one of those things. You write these stories, and it's kind of like, well, what do you? It stays with you. The stories, like your stories, are like grits. They stick to your ribs. And then so you go on off to pursue your career to write the great American novel.
Well, yeah. I mean, Larry McMurtry grew up in Archer City, which is 20 miles from Wichita Falls. And all of us read The Last Picture Show, and we could not believe that stories we knew about were being printed in a book. It was sort of our experience that you can write. You can make a living as a writer. And if you're in Larry McMurtry's shoes, you might have sex with Sybil Shepherd. So I went to TCU, wrote sports for the school newspaper, The Skiff, graduated from college, got a job at one of the Dallas newspapers writing fluffy feature stories.
But you would also, if you had a chance, you'd go off and do some police blotter stuff.
Yeah. When the crime reporters went on vacation, I volunteered to take their place for 2 weeks. And usually the editor, the City Room editor, would say, no, you're too young. Go back to writing fluffy features. You have a knack for that. So like a man was walking backwards across the entirety of the United States. And my lead was, backward came he. Backward like a crab. Come on back, Pliny L. Wingo, way back. And the editor thought I was a genius.
But were you still thinking about these murders? Were you drawn to the pulp fiction of the time, those spinning racks of the drugstore and those tawdry tales of woe?
I would stand in front. Remember the old spin racks at the drugstores? And the top parts would be UFO books, and then you'd go down to true serial killers. They were called thrill killers back then. And I would stand there and leaf through these thrill killer books and think, this is unbelievably fascinating. Now, why would I care that much about these kind of stories unless I was depraved? And I don't have an answer for that one.
So when Truman Capote writes a book, you know, in Cold Blood, does that resonate with you? Like, this can be literature? This can be something more than just spin rack pulp?
Yeah. I thought I could finally make a profession out of it. And interestingly, even back then, I knew that Texas Monthly was going to be the place to go, because there were some dynamite writers who believed in the power of a crime story. Every writer on the staff was encouraged to
write a crime story. You're not going to make it at Texas Monthly, one of the writers told me, Jim Atkinson, unless you write a crime story.
So I would cut out these stories in the newspapers, these short little stories that I thought might make a feature story for Texas Monthly, 8,000, 10,000 words. One of the articles I cut out was about this cowboy robbing banks in suburban Dallas. He wore this big 10-gallon hat, had a beard, full beard, sunglasses, leather jacket, cowboy boots, and he drove up in a Dodge, and he came out, he kept his head down. He walked up to the teller and would hand her a note that would say, "This is a bank robbery, give me your money, no bait bills." Bait bills are the bills that when they go through the detector machine would explode and shoot dye all over the bank robber. He was getting away with it time after time after time until finally
someone caught up with him through a license plate check, went to arrest him. It was a woman. They found her just as she was trying to get some dye off of her face or some glue. The FBI agent who had done bank robberies for years had a meeting with his fellow officers and said, "Gentlemen, Cowboy Bob is now Cowboy Bobette." There was this richness of a story you could tell. How did this woman, middle-aged, middle-class, lived in a with her mother in an apartment in Garland? She'd done nothing in her life, nothing. She had just gone to work. She drove a car for a courier service delivering packages. Her name was Peggy Jo Tallis. And one day she said, "I'm going to rob a bank." Where does that come from? People can be divided into two sides. One is you walk in to a bank and you immediately start looking around thinking, where are the cameras? Where's the security guard? Could I get away with it? And then the other side, of course, are normal people, unlike anyone in this room, think the whole idea of robbing a bank just sounds insane. And it was.
But she was very calm. She didn't even have a gun.
It was not violent. And even the FBI agent that ran the operation against her, ran the case, he admired her. There were times when I would interview him and I thought he was a little bit in love with her. Which I understood. I was a little bit in love with her myself. She goes off to prison for 3 years. They say, you know, she was just a woman with middle-aged crazy. She had no criminal record. Give her a second chance after 3 years. Psychologist came to interview her. He had interviewed all kinds of criminals for the federal government. And this one took the cake because she came into the interview room. She lit a cigarette. He says, "Why did you rob those banks?" She crossed her legs. And she looked at him and smiled. And at some point, her mom died, and she bought a $4,000 RV, used, barely could get up a hill, with purple curtains framing the windows. And she stayed in those little public parks you could stay in by lakes. Then she disappeared. And about 2 years later, a story began to come out. A man who sure could have been a woman had robbed a bank in Tyler. Now, if the FBI agent that I knew had not retired, he would have realized who was behind him. You know, the new generation of FBI agents said, "Well, it's got to be a man." So it was a man who had some feminine tendencies. And it was Peggy Jo. And in the last scene of her life, she robs another bank in Tyler. She jumps in her RV. She had missed the bank bills, so they went off. Police begin to follow her. Citizens of Tyler begin to follow her. It was the greatest posse chase in Texas history. She drove up a hill and into a cul-de-sac and was immediately surrounded by police. And they said, "Come on out, sir." And she did. And then she said something to them. And what happened next can almost bring tears to your eyes if you're a sick true crime addict. And I'm going to tell you what it is after you buy the book. You know, I'll send a...
Her favorite movie was...
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
But she was a free spirit who refused to be caged by expectations, and she just wanted to live life wild.
I'm so glad you said that. I forgot this part. She dropped out of high school and bought a Fiat. And with her friend Cherry, they drove to San Francisco from Grand Prairie in the suburb of Dallas, drove to San Francisco so they could stop at the City Lights bookstore, so she could try to meet Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who had written a poem about people driving down bland highways, looking at bland billboards. And she says, you know, she didn't want money. She didn't want a family. She didn't want a retirement package. She just wanted to be in her RV and stay out at the beach or out by the lake and be left alone. How can you not feel for her?
Okay, there's a lot to talk about, but I want to make sure we get to a story because we have some folks here who are connected to this story. All right. So in the book, O Sister, Where Art Thou? Talk about that and talk about what we got going on here.
Well, one of the stories I've always liked to write is historical pieces on long ago crimes and what happened. So, like, I spent years on this book about these murders in Austin in the year 1884. And then one day I'm with my wife and her daughter, and we're driving past Huntsville, and we stop in the Huntsville Museum, the prison museum. This is when the prison museum was on the town square. You know, it's just that musty, classic, small-town museum. Haley is looking at this photo of these women in Dale Evans' cowgirl costumes playing guitars. And I said, what's that? Haley goes, what is that? And I asked the curator of the museum, I said, what is that? He goes, I don't know. They were prison inmates who I think might have formed a country band, but I don't know. And I told Shannon, I said, I hear the sound of money. Turns out that this group of female inmates formed a band. Back then, everybody was in the Gore unit. Every woman was in the Gore unit, which you can see still the original signage along I-45, right as you get past that statue of Sam, what's his name? They formed a band, and they were on a show that WBAP Radio in Dallas, Fort Worth ran every Wednesday night called Behind the Walls, because it was right next, the show was behind the great prison walls of downtown Huntsville. I started searching, and there was almost no one around. I found a couple of women that are in the story. 3 days ago, I get an email. You ready? Okay, Paula's here. Donna's here. Tell them who you are, Donna.
I'm the niece of one of the women that was in the Gore band.
And y'all didn't even know about it until you read that article.
Get this mic'd up.
So this is what happened. There's still some of these remnants of a lost world. Women who had been arrested and charged with, what was your aunt charged with?
She was supposed to have assaulted a man and took his money. Now, I figure he slapped her on the butt and she got red. Because that was in 1935 and she was a good-looking waitress.
1935 and what?
And she was a good-looking waitress.
Good-looking waitress.
And women didn't have really much church, you know.
So here's this lost world that comes back to life periodically, and it came back to life 3 days ago because y'all happened to read that story in the book.
What happened is we were having an argument on who died first. I heard her mother or her aunt. And I was saying, oh, no, Mom, Aunt Lily died after. And she's like, no. So I went on there online. I'm like, I knew it. But the first thing I found was your story about Lily Mae Dudley being in the Gory Girls. So I called my mom and I said, didn't Aunt Lily spend time in prison? And she said, yeah, for bootlegging or something like that. And I was like, okay. And she goes, but she was a great seamstress. That's what he So I said, that's not right. So I went on to Ancestry.com and I looked at the 1940 census and her aunt Lily was not on the census. And I called her back. I'm like, Mom, all the brothers and sisters are on here, but Aunt Lily's not there. What's going on? I don't know. You know, she's, I don't know. But then I found her later on the 1940 census in Huntsville. I'm like, she was in prison. And she was a Gory girl. I've got to get a hold of Skip, so I emailed you directly. And I said, I just found out something we never knew. And my mom said that they never told stories about why she was in prison. So we never knew that she was a Gory girl.
And she was sterilized.
And that
like
she was
all
sterilized.
Those women inmates were back then.
Uh-huh.
Because the theory was among the male prison officials was you don't want that bad gene getting passed down to the next generation. who will commit even worse crimes. But this is why I love to write for Texas Monthly. It's not because I like to write for them. It's to run across a family like this.
Well, you did like a bunch of research that in a couple of days, how long have you been working on that story? You need a job in journalism?
She was pardoned. Remember, she was pardoned, too.
So she was pardoned. How did that work out?
Well, we still can't do the math because she was pardoned in 1940, but she was released in 1945. I don't know.
Prison system moves slow.
That's a story, a compelling story, part of Texas lore. But the one thing, so you write about these stories. And I want to talk about this element. They feel very Texas. They all feel like people kill each other all over the world, all over the nation, but these all feel so much like Texas. Is that something that you go for, or is that just part of the deal?
Yes and yes. You know, part of it is people will say, why are there so many good crimes in Texas? And the answer is, it's because Texas Monthly is there to write about them. There's probably a gory story up in Oklahoma. But, you know, what writer is going to go to Oklahoma to hunt down a story? You know, to me, the bigger question is, why do we love these women, even the savage women? If you buy the book, read the story on Nurse Vicky. We've had a lot of great serial killers come out of Texas, but none like Vicky Dawn Jackson. She had 26 neatly pressed nurses' outfits that she kept hanging in the closet, and she'd put one on because she worked the night shift. She'd stop at the Dairy Queen, the only restaurant of renown in Nakona, where North Texas, where she grew up. And she would stop at Dairy Queen and always have the same meal, 2 tacos, dinner salad with ranch dressing, iced tea, sweet. She would eat it, then throw her trash away in the little trash receptacle and get in her car and drive up to the hospital, which is like an 18-bed hospital, one of the smallest in the state. And for years, she was Florence Nightingale. She cared about those patients. She changed them, fixed their wounds, took care of them, read them stories at night, let them slap her, and she wouldn't say anything. And then one day, she decided to pull out some Mivarium chloride, which is a drug that can stop the respiratory system, and she began injecting it into patients. Over a period of 2 months, she murdered 10 people, 10 patients that were in the hospital.
But the people that she murdered, they were not strangers.
Well, I mean, in Nakona, everybody knows each other. But I kept thinking, you know, she pled no contest, and she went off to prison. There was no trial, no testimony, until she started agreeing to let us talk to her. And what emerged, what clearly emerged after all kinds, just infinite number of interviews, and she was so sweet. It'd be like, hello, Mr. Hollinsworth, did you have a nice drive up from your home? There was one woman who wore this black dress that, you know, one of those, the zipper went all the way up and down the front. Her name was Vicky Pelkey, something Pelkey. And she was the sort of the star attraction at the Country Western nightclub. All the men wanted to dance with her, and none of them wanted to dance with Vicky. And that's when I began to realize what was up. Over the years, she had harbored these resentments. She tried to hide them away. She was a wallflower of a girl as a teenager. No one would let her get in the car and drive around with them around the town square. She would wear what she said were cute Western tops to the bar, but no one would dance with her. She married the loser of a guy, and he divorced her after having an affair or two. And, you know, she had to pay child support. And yet she was so devoted to her job, she had 26 nurses' uniforms neatly pressed in her closet. Until one day she said, I'm tired of this. Now, she didn't tell me this, but just think of what happened. She injected a 100-year-old lady with Mivarium chloride. She then had, you know, older men, a boy who tried to ask out Vicky's daughter. Vicky's daughter said no, and so the boy tried to hurt her, and Vicky decided he would hurt her, but she would hurt him back. And all of this savage killings began. Savage. And yet, did you feel
there was this comedy about it. Did you feel just a little bit of sympathy for what she had been through? You know, it's like Carrie in the Stephen King novel. What made her go from this portrait of gentleness? I mean, she made casseroles for the families to saying, I give up. She turned to this vengeance, and it somehow made her feel really good.
If they caught her, and then she went to go work at the town over as a nurse?
Well, you know, it's hard to find a good nurse in North Texas.
So the moral of the story is be nice to your nurse. Susan Wright, she was known as the blue-eyed butcher.
Yeah. Do we have time?
All right, 4 or 5 minutes. The Evelyn Woods version of 193 stab wounds. So it took her longer to kill her husband than we have to actually tell the story.
She was polite, soft-spoken.
She's a former stripper.
Thin. Well, but just for a few weeks. It doesn't mean that she was a bad person. She just was sweet to everyone, and she let her husband begin to abuse her. And finally, she broke and stabbed him 193 times. Now, y'all know Kelly Siegler. Does that name ring a bell? She's the Houston prosecutor, former Houston prosecutor, who would take on Dick DeGaron in these great showcase of trials. And so they were going to have this one. And she went after, she had her assistant prosecutor, a male, lay down on the actual bed, which she had brought out into the courtroom where the killings occurred. And among the blood-stained sheets and so on, he sat there, like, laid there like this. And he put a chaw of tobacco in his mouth, you know, to deal with this unfortunate situation he was in. And so while Kelly is like calling out what this woman did, she began to count out 193 blows over this man's body. The assistant prosecutor finally began to do this kind of movement. And we all thought he was having some kind of sexual experience with Kelly. And she's this beautiful woman. And, you know, she took off one of her high heels and was doing this and pretending to stab him.
You can find that on YouTube, by the way.
You can, I think.
You can. I saw it.
It's okay. You know, so Kelly would count it out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
And it wasn't a sexual experience. He was choking on his chewing tobacco.
She kills, not everyone in the book is a killer, all the women, especially the cowboy Bob. But you know, is that attracted to you? Just to wrap this up, you know, are you drawn to the femme fatale?
This sounds sexist, but women are always considered the gentler sex. So there's something that throws us into a tizzy when a woman is arrested for a spectacular crime. You know, he goes all the way back to Lizzie Borden. There's a trial that I wrote about in Houston in the 60s involving Candace Mussler, the socialite whose husbands kept dying. And she was finally put on trial. She was acquitted, like, just as fast as the snap of the fingers, because the men just could not imagine that a woman in high heels and a tight little dress cinched at the waist would commit murder.
That and more in this hot book right here. Skip Hollingsworth is an executive editor at Texas Monthly. His new book is She Kills, The Murderous Socialite, The Cross-Dressing Bank Robber, and Other True Crime Tales. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.